Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Happy Tuesday morning. Thanks for listening to the show here on 91.5 KJZZ in Phoenix with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Coming up this hour, we'll update the now fully contained Woodbury fire and learn about the potential for desalinating water in Arizona.
But first, the number of days with a heat index higher than 100 degrees in Arizona could more than double by the middle of the century. The number of days with a heat index higher than 105 could more than quadruple by mid-century. Those numbers are based on the current rates of emissions and climate change and come from an analysis done by the Union of Concerned Scientists. With me to talk more about what researchers found is Astrid Caldas, a senior climate scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists and one of the report's co-authors. Astrid, good morning.
Good morning.
This seems pretty stark that if things basically don't change, it's going to get a whole lot hotter, both in the Southwest and more specifically in Arizona.
That's correct. The southern part of the country is going to see a significant increase in those extreme heat days where the heat index is going to top 100, 105, and even be off the charts of the National Weather Service calculation for the heat index.
When you talk about off the charts, I know that was a category in your research. What does that mean, and how could Arizona look in that regard?
The off-the-charts days, we call, are the days where the combination of temperature and humidity, which are the two variables used by the National Weather Service to calculate the heat index, those numbers together are going to produce a level of heat index that is above the current reliable measured heat index level, which is to say the formula used cannot be reliably the formula that the National Weather Service uses cannot be reliably used to calculate the heat index when the temperature is so high and the humidity is so high. That heat index is usually above 127 degrees Fahrenheit, so that's off the charts.
Let me ask you about the two aspects of the heat index, both the heat itself and the humidity. Arizona, of course, is known for having a dry heat, although this time of year that humidity does tend to creep up a bit. When you look at what could happen based on how emissions go down the road, are you looking at an increase in both heat and humidity? Is one expected to go up more than the other?
That is correct. The temperature is expected to increase for sure. The humidity has a lot more local influence, but what we know is that with the warmer air holds more water vapor, so it is likely that the humidity will also increase with higher temperatures.
In your analysis, you looked at basically three scenarios, one where emissions continue sort of as they are, one where everybody basically keeps the Paris Climate Accord, and one that was sort of in the middle. I'm wondering if things, like, is it possible, I guess, that to sort of put the genie back in the bottle in terms of what has happened so far in terms of emissions and climate change?
It is. It is, because what we are feeling right now comes from emissions that have been released in the atmosphere up until now. And if we start reducing the emissions right now until mid-century, the second half of the century can have a much different picture in terms of not only extreme heat, which responds more readily to emissions, but also other climate change impacts. Yes.
All right. Well, that is Astrid Caldas, a senior climate scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists, one of the report's co-authors, talking about the potential for increased heat and humidity across the country. Astrid, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
There is an excessive heat warning in effect today for the Phoenix area. The National Weather Service says the high could reach 115. We topped out at 114 yesterday. The Maricopa County Public Health Department says there have been three confirmed heat-related deaths so far this year, with 37 more cases under investigation. Both numbers are higher than over the same time last year. With me to talk about the impact this heat can have and is having is Dr. David Brodkin. He's a pediatric hospitalist at Maricopa Medical Center. And Dr. Brodkin, what has the hospital seen so far this summer in terms of people affected by the heat?
Right. Yeah, the summer is definitely the peak time when people or patients are at risk for injury or illness related to the heat, particularly in that July, August, September range where the temperatures are peaking. So we see patients who are suffering from heat exhaustion and even sometimes in the more severe circumstances, heat stroke, which is the more significant complications that go beyond heat exhaustion.
One of the things that we keep hearing about summer after summer is that the evening low temperatures are not getting down as far as they used to. How significant is that in terms of folks who are then affected maybe the next day by heat when it hasn't really had a chance to cool down the night before?
For sure. I think that's really just a sign of how extreme the heat gets, in the sense that at nighttime, the lows may even still be in the 90s. So it's really never getting to a cool point. Certainly, the peak hours during the day when the sun is up is when patients are really at risk for the most severe circumstances, when the sun starts rising above the horizon and the sun is beating down. You have that on top of the extreme temperatures.
What role does humidity play in all of this? Because, you hear so much, oh, it's a dry heat. If it's 110, maybe you go in the shade and it's a little more bearable. But when the humidity starts creeping up, I mean, I feel less comfortable. I would imagine that that doesn't do much for folks who are really suffering.
For sure. The humidity actually does play a role in our climate in Arizona. I suppose that's the one benefit from the heat perspective, is that it is a dry heat, as they say. But really what it comes down to is the body has certain mechanisms for controlling the temperature, controlling the body's temperature. And a big one, of course, is the sweating mechanism. And the more significant the humidity, the more that sweating mechanism might be impacted. So a humid environment of equivalent temperatures may be more challenging than, say, the same temperature at a drier climate.
One of the things that the Maricopa County Medical Examiner's Office has found, which I think is kind of interesting, is that a lot of folks who actually die from heat-related illnesses are not necessarily new to Arizona, but people who have lived here for a while. Do our bodies ever acclimate to this kind of heat and these kinds of conditions? I mean, is it surprising to you that folks who succumb to the heat are folks who have been here for some amount of time?
I think there is some degree of adaptation that the human body can undergo by living in a hot environment or hot climate for a significant period of time. However, that really does not take away the risk of, heat exhaustion and heat stroke that we see during the summer. And really, ultimately, what it comes down to is everyone's at risk when it comes to being in the heat of the day, particularly when the sun is up. And particularly if there's other risk factors that are associated, such as underlying medical conditions, certain medications. And of course, if one is exerting themselves in that kind of heat, then that also will put them at significant risk as well.
For the patients who find their way to your hospital, do you find that many or most of them have some kind of underlying health concern that the heat sort of exacerbates?
I think the biggest thing that we see are those patients who have those social challenges, the homeless, those who don't have air conditioning at home, those who are in that lower socioeconomic status where they just may be having more difficulty getting to a cool place during the day. And that is probably the biggest thing. But for sure, patients who have underlying medical conditions, that they're also significantly at risk as well. So I would say those two broad categories are the big ones that we really see.
In the category of heat exhaustion, maybe not quite going to the heat stroke level, how easy or difficult is it to treat those patients and sort of get them back on their feet?
If they're not too far down that road, it is something that can be treated fairly quickly, in the sense that treating them supportively with IV fluids is usually the biggest thing, and getting their body temperatures to cool down, and then treating them supportively in whatever manner. In the more severe cases where it starts turning into more of a heat stroke situation, that's where more permanent damage can happen to major organs in the body, like such as the heart or the brain.
In general, do you and your colleagues at the hospital notice maybe a particular high temperature where you really start to see more and more people coming into the hospital, like a sort of a threshold where if it's below this temperature, you might get a few folks, but if it gets above whatever that temperature is, that you really start to see people suffering?
I think there's not one particular number, but I would say the most extreme heat when you're starting to get above 110 is when you see the peak incidence of patients coming in with heat-related illness.
All right, that's Dr. David Bronkin. He's a pediatric hospitalist at Maricopa Integrated Health Systems in Phoenix. Dr. Bronkin, thanks a lot for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
The state's largest wildfire so far this year is all but out. The Woodbury Fire began June 8th just northeast of Apache Junction. So far, it's burned more than 123,000 acres, making it the fifth largest wildfire in state history. Dangers remain as some roads and recreation areas in the Tonto National Forest are closed. Right now, forest personnel are assessing landscape damage, while crews monitor and mop up the remaining flames that burn along the northwest perimeter of the fire. Brandilyn Vonk is a public information officer for the Woodbury Fire. And Brandilyn, we know that it's 100% contained but not 100% controlled. What's the difference between those designations?
So what contained means is we have a line established all around the perimeter of the fire that has been tested, and incident management team operations feel that that fire will not breach beyond that line. What controlled is we're not controlled because we still see active fire and smoke within the perimeter.
So this was one of the largest fires in Arizona history. It took more than a month to put out. Can you address some of the difficulties faced in fighting this wildfire, depending on terrain, location?
So the biggest difficulty with the Woodbury Fire was the terrain. It was steep, hazardous, rocky terrain, and it wasn't terrain that we could put our firefighters in and still keep them safe. And safety for our firefighters and the public is always our number one priority.
Remind us how it got started and how it was able to grow in such a sense, because it does seem as though, because it did potentially pose some danger to firefighters, but not necessarily to structures, it was allowed to grow. Is that sort of the process?
Well, so the fire, with still unknown what the cause is, that's going to take a determination from a fire investigator for us to get that actual cause. And as far as putting the firefighters in, like I said, it's all about safety. And it was in the Superstition Wilderness for the majority of it. So we didn't have any values at risk. And by values at risk, I mean structures being one of those values at risk, or infrastructure. So the decision was made to allow the fire to move to an area where we could safely put our firefighters in and then work on putting that fire down.
So now that we've determined the 100% containment, where are we at now in terms of what folks involved with the response team are doing? What's the assessment process like?
So right now we have what's called a BEAR team. That stands for Burned Area Emergency Response. And they are a group of scientists, such as hydrologists, soil, wildlife biologists. They come in and they collect data both on the ground and via satellite imagery. And they compiled a report that we received at the end of last week. So from the process here moving forward, that report is going to be presented with other agency officials such as ADOT later this week in a meeting. And we're hoping that out of that meeting, we'll get a more definitive timeline on what's going to happen with the closures currently in place and moving forward from there as far as allowing public back into the area.
Brandilyn, I just had one more question for you. We know we're getting very close. Could be as soon as this weekend that the valley actually starts to see monsoon activity. As we know, that could be dust, that could be lightning, that could eventually be rain. Are there any concerns about potential dangers in that area of the fire now that monsoon storms or once they arrive?
So there's always a potential for monsoons to affect a burned area, because as that fire comes through, it's burned vegetation, and now that vegetation is no longer holding the soil together. So we can see things move around. We can see debris being pushed down onto the roads. And for public safety, that's why we still have closures in place. We do have alerts currently set up with the National Weather Service in Phoenix, as well as NOAA. And they kind of keep us up to date on the potential for those monsoonal or those storms to come over the Woodbury Scar area just so we can have an idea what we need to prepare for in order to keep our firefighters and the public safe.
Brandilyn Vonk is Public Information Officer for the Woodbury Fire. There have been limits on federal funding for research into injuries and deaths related to firearms for more than two decades. That makes a new study into guns and child deaths and injuries potentially extremely impactful. 20 researchers worked on the project, coming from varying fields, including public health. One of them is Jesenia Pizarro, associate professor at ASU's School of Criminology and Criminal Justice. I spoke with her and began by asking why there had been a limit on funding this kind of research.
Yes, and it all can be traced back to the 1996 Dickey Amendment, which was included in the funding bills that indicated that research funds, that funds, federal funds, cannot be used for lobbying against firearms. And as a result of that, that was taken to mean that you couldn't fund research in the area. But in 2018, a clarification was added to the amendment saying that that doesn't forbid the use of federal funds to study the root causes of firearm violence.
Let's talk about a couple of things. What are some risk factors that come into mind for you? And are there things that are risk factors that really don't need to be based on if people just had more information or took different action?
Well, one of the biggest risk factors for victimization and offending is having an easy access to a firearm in the home. So those are things that can easily be manipulated with safety techniques and safety training and safe storage that can actually help. Another risk factor that's not as easy to manipulate would be substance and drug abuse. But given right now the current climate and the current issues related to drug use, this is something that's interrelated. So we know that children and teens who are abusing alcohol and drugs are more likely to be victims and offenders. And then if you combine that with abusing alcohol and drugs and having an easy access to a firearm in the home, then that increases the risk significantly.
Mm-hmm. Were there things that you went into that even surprised you?
Well, one of the big things that surprised me was the lack of research in the area. So a lot of the things we take it as common knowledge and we live by anecdotes. And when we started doing this work and we started pulling the literature and seeing that, you know, there's no study that have examined school risk factors, for example. There's not a lot of work on suicide prevention, which is also one of the areas that we're tackling. So I was very surprised by the lack of empirical evidence to support a lot of the discourse that's going on now. I was also surprised by the inconsistency between the rhetoric and what we know research-wise. So research-wise, we know that the findings related to mental health are very inconclusive. Some studies find no relationship. Other studies find a moderate relationship. But nationally, the discourse tends to be it's a mental health issue. But there's not a lot of evidence to support that.
Well, you mentioned how car accidents are still the number one killer of young people. I imagine that's been dramatically reduced as we've seen seatbelts, airbags, that kind of thing. Are there logical steps, again, knowing that there's this is a very political bent, are there logical things that could be done to prevent gun deaths in the same way that we've been able to at least not prevent, but based on how many people drive, I imagine the percentages are much, much more stark when it comes to guns than when it comes to cars.
Yes, well, let me just start by saying that in the past 50 years, due to injury prevention research and heavy funding that went into automobile fatalities, we were able to decrease the auto fatalities among children and teens by 90%. And as you know, we have not decreased the use of cars in the past 50 years.
That's correct.
So we did that by implementing safety techniques, things like the car seat for children, like you mentioned, airbags, seatbelt laws. So and that generally did not infringe on people's right to own a vehicle, even though it's not a constitutional right. So we can implement similar things like that. For example, one of the things that I've been researching is the effect of child access laws. And we know that child access laws have a positive effect on decreasing the mortality and injuries among children and teens. We know that laws, extreme protective order laws, research is starting to show that they have an effect on preventing domestic violence incidents, where unfortunately children tend to be involved in these incidents as victims as well. So there are common sense things that we can do and take a page from the automobile fatality research in terms of safety standards that can actually save lives.
So considering the fact that you've had this, there's been this limit for a quarter century or so as far as doing more research on this, would we be surprised if the average person thought, oh, this is really good research, we're glad you're doing it? Was there anything that surprised you about that in terms of that maybe more people actually are really really happy to know that there's real information out there that they can learn from it? Was there a dynamic that surprised you there?
Well, this is an area that has been very welcomed by the general public. And unlike what we see in the news media and the rhetoric politically, more people want to keep their children safe. More people want to know ways to keep their children safe and are receptive to safety tactics and toolkits that we can give them to inform how they do their business every day and how they handle their weapons in the home. So this has generally been considered a taboo type of thing. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't want to mention firearms. You don't want to do this type of work. People don't want it. But the reality is that people generally do want it. I haven't encountered someone yet that have told me that we don't want this knowledge, that we don't want this type of research. Mm-hmm. That's been very surprising and refreshing, because the fact that parents are being involved now and the general public is saying it's enough. There's no reason why 2,500 children need to be dying in this country every year over something that's preventable is actually giving us, I would say, more momentum to continue doing this type of work and to keep pushing forward.
Jesenia Pizarro is an associate professor at ASU School of Criminology and Criminal Justice.
Arizona Senators Martha McSally and Kyrsten Sinema may have had an epic battle on the campaign trail last year, but now they're joining together to sponsor a bill that works to address our region's dry future. The bill would set aside hundreds of millions of dollars to support things like water recycling, desalination plants, and water storage projects. But how big of a dent could projects like these have on our water future? For more on that, our co-host Lauren Gilger sat down with Sarah Porter, director of the Kyle Center for Water Policy at the Morrison Institute at ASU.
Being able to pick from a variety of different approaches depending on the locality and the available water supply can make a huge difference for water resilience all over the Southwest. So it can be significant. We do a lot of water reuse in Arizona, but some communities are looking at doing even more, and specifically putting direct potable reuse in their future. So adding that kind of reuse can greatly increase a city's water portfolio. Underground storage is something that's being deployed all over Arizona. That kind of aquifer recharge and recovery is something Arizona's water managers are really good at. Having funding to be able to develop infrastructure to add that kind of water cycle, that treatment, recharge, recovery, is helpful. But the other big piece of this bill is that we have a lot of infrastructure that's really, really old. I think the average age of Bureau of Reclamation infrastructure is something like 80. We have all these dams that are 100 years old or 80 or 75 years old. And having the financing to enable the managers of these big projects to bring them up to date, to make sure that they're not losing lots of water through the kinds of leaks and breaks that occur as a system ages, that's also an important part of long-term water resilience.
So some of this in your mind would be used just to upgrade and upkeep the systems we already have in place.
Yeah, and that really is part of staying water resilient.
Yeah, yeah. What about desalination? I mean, that's one that we've talked about in Arizona. We have a desalination plant in Arizona, I think,
yeah,
but I don't
do.
Think it works.
I think it's being kept in condition to work if it were needed. It's it's located in Yuma, and it isn't the kind of desalination plant that, I mean, it does desalinate water, but it's not for what people mostly think of when they think of desalination. Typically, when we think of desalination, we're thinking of taking water that's brackish or salty and running it through filters so that that water can be an augmentation to current supplies. And so ocean desal is one option, and there are serious conversations going on between the United States and Mexico about a potential binational ocean desalination project. For Arizona to benefit from a project like that, probably Arizona would need, or some water users in Arizona would need, to reach a deal in which Mexican water users or managers would agree to take ocean desalination in place of some of the Colorado River supplies that would be delivered to Mexico. And then those Colorado River supplies could be delivered via the CAP or to other parts of Arizona.
Right, because it wouldn't obviously be ocean water we'd want to desalinate here.
It would be very, very expensive to desalinate ocean water and then have to pump it to any place in Arizona.
Right.
So we're probably not looking at that.
So how does this square with the drought contingency plan we've been talking about for so long now that has finally just been approved and is sort of set up to deal with the same question about Colorado River water? Is this sort of our leaders looking at the reality of the situation and saying at some point we're not going to have the Colorado River water we need, and so we need to think of other ways to innovate?
I think that water managers and leaders are saying there's a possibility of reduced Colorado River supplies, and so we need to have a number of different strategies for responding to that. There's still quite a bit of opportunity within the state for voluntary reallocation. There are water rights holders who may be willing, under the right circumstances, to lease or sell some of their water to other places that need it. So we don't need to rush to building desalination plants or other kinds of expensive projects, but we need to be those projects often take a long time to sort of plan and get approved. And so it's important to be working on those.
So the other sort of question I have about this bill is the approach. Like, is legislative action, is federal money going to be the future of this? Like, is that going to be the way we have to fund the future of our water preservation in the Southwest? Or is this going to be a combination of that and market needs?
Yeah. Well, we really relied out in the West on federal funding. So it's not new for communities to be looking to federal financing for help. We've been sort of reckoning over the last decade or so with what feels like a new reality, which is that the kind of financing that was available back in the day isn't available anymore. It used to be, even with the CAP, that the federal government would come in and just pick up the tab for the front costs to build these projects. And then water users, the water authority, would be required to pay back that financing over a very long term. Mm. We are still paying back the loan that the federal government extended in the late 70s to pay for the CAP.
So this is not a debt-free solution.
No. I mean, it's a really interesting area, and I think we often overlook this, that we expect the water users, the people who benefit from the water project, to pay for the water project. And that really brings up an issue that I think is sometimes the hardest issue to grapple with in water supply, and that is that to pay for that project, you have to have a good shot at having the population base or the user base to pay it off.
Right.
And so some places around the state look like pretty good bets for that. There are other places that may be water challenged, and they may not be such good bets for those loans because it is unlikely that they'll develop that kind of population or water user capacity to pay back the loan. We do need to think about where it makes sense to grow.
All right. Sarah Porter is the director of the Kyle Center for Water Policy at the Morrison Institute at ASU. Sarah, thank you for coming in.
Sure. Thanks very much.
Good Tuesday morning. This is the show on 91.5 with Mark Brody in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. Still to come, we'll learn about whether SAT scores are losing their relevance. And stay tuned to 10 for the takeaway. It is monsoon season here in the Valley almost, and we're bringing you our series Monsoon Stories this summer. And we need your help. This year, we're telling stories about how the monsoon storms tickle our five senses, how they look, feel, sound, smell, and even taste. If you want to join in, there are plenty of ways. Just go to monsoon.kjzz.org, find out how to tell us your story, or send us the best monsoon photo you've captured. Your story could end up on the air, and your photo will be featured on the website.
Most of Arizona is free of drought in the short term, according to the State Department of Water Resources, although long-term drought continues to affect the state. And as other states and countries also deal with water scarcity, my next guest says desalination has become an increasingly popular option. Jim Robbins is a freelance journalist based in Helena, Montana, and has written about this. And Jim, how big of an increase are we seeing in the use of desalination?
Well, you're seeing a number of large plants being built around the world. The big one in North America is the desal plant or desalination plant in Carlsbad near San Diego, which is a billion-dollar facility and can produce 50 million gallons a day. They're building another similar size plant in the same area of California or similar area. And you've seen a lot of construction of big plants in Australia. Israel has embraced desal. They have a number of large plants, so it's really growing. It's really seen as an important alternative, although an expensive one, for these countries that are facing water shortages.
Yeah, let me ask you about the economics of it, because this technology has obviously been around for quite a while. I mean, there have been desalination plants for many, many years. How have the economics changed to make it maybe more palatable or at least more doable for some of these cities or countries?
Well, one thing that's happened is the cost of desalination has come down in the last several decades, about half of what it was. But then the cost of other sources has gone up. San Diego, for example, gets Colorado River water, and it has to be pumped hundreds of miles. And it's expensive. Electricity is expensive for pumping water. And so it pays about $1,200 an acre foot. And desalination now is about twice that for an acre foot. So it's getting closer. The other big factor is that it's certain. It's not something that's going to go away. Colorado River water across the Southwest is threatened because of the shortage of water in Lake Mead. So this is a way of assuring a supply, even if it costs twice as much. And that's a very important factor.
Are there technologies or other ways of maybe bringing the price down even more so that it becomes even more doable for municipalities or for governments?
Yes, there's a number of new approaches to desalination that are being experimented with. The other thing that municipalities are looking at is treatment of brackish water. Arizona in particular is looking at, it has something like 600 million acre feet underground of brackish water deposits. And brackish water is quite a bit cheaper to treat than salt water because there's less salt content.
You mentioned the Colorado River and the shortage that a lot of folks are saying is coming in the not too distant future. Arizona, of course, relies in large part on the Colorado River. Is Arizona, do you think, a good candidate for desalination technology?
Well, it's certainly looking at it. I think it has to look for alternatives to make sure its supply is certain. So what are their alternatives? Well, they've banked a lot of water underground, but they're now looking at, seriously, things like brackish water desalination and creating a water treatment facility with Mexico on the Gulf of California. People are thinking about it, but I don't think the economics are there yet.
You also, in your article, write about some of the environmental impacts of desalination plants in the sense that, for one, they use a lot of energy, which some might argue almost kind of defeats the purpose of trying to use them as an environmental benefit.
Right. I think about a third of the cost of a plant is the energy costs. And, you know, depending on where they get their energy, from a fossil fuel plant or something, it could contribute to climate change. That's what's going on in the Middle East, where they use more desalination plants than anywhere else. They have cheap fossil fuels, oil available there, and so the power is cheap. but they're, you know, contributing greenhouse gases from using all these desal plants. And some experts warn that as climate changes and places get drier and have to rely more on desalination, that you'll have a positive feedback loop where you build more plants, you create more climate change, and it keeps going on and on. And so there's some concern about that.
Within the industry, is there a sense of what the ultimate potential of desalination is? Like, is there somebody who predicts that X percent of drinking water in the U.S. or globally will be produced in desalination plants at some point down the road?
I haven't heard a number of how much water will be produced in desalination plants. I think right now, 300 million people get their water, their fresh water from desal plants. But it's definitely going to grow. You have huge cities like Cape Town in South Africa, like Sao Paulo in Brazil, which just went through a drought, and on, for whom water security is a serious problem. And when you start to look around, there aren't too many alternatives for these large cities except for desalination.
Jim Robbins is a freelance journalist based in Helena, Montana. He talked about the potential for using desalination in Arizona. And for more on that, I turn to Tom Bouchotsky, director of the Arizona Department of Water Resources. And Tom, when you look at the list of potential solutions for Arizona's water issues, where is desalination on that list? How much potential do you think this method might actually have for the state?
So I think the potential for desalination to meet some of our future water needs is a very large potential. We do have areas within our state that have brackish groundwater that we could desalinate. And we are in discussions with Mexico about binational desalination opportunities in the Sea of Cortez.
When you talk about brackish water, I mean, how much is there and what is the process for making that potable relative to, for example, ocean water?
So there are several areas in the state that have large deposits, and I don't have volumes for you, of brackish groundwater, one in the West Valley, in the Yuma area, and then kind of south of the Navajo Reservation in northeastern Arizona. Those brackish groundwater desalination processes are actually cheaper than desalinating ocean water because the salinity is lower. One of the big challenges there is disposal of the brine. You cannot obviously dispose of it in an ocean when it's internal to Arizona, but there are methods that can be used to get rid of that brine. But that's where one of the bigger costs will come to the state if we do in-state brackish groundwater desalination.
Do you see a potential future for the desal plant that's already built and has been sitting in Yuma for a number of years now?
So that plant has challenges in terms of it being used in any meaningful way for large quantities of water to be desalinated. It needs substantial upgrades in terms of infrastructure, and some of that is for safety issues. I think the last number that I saw just to get that plant back up to speed was like something like $25 million. The technology in that plant is very outdated, so it would be an expensive proposition. You do have the plant there itself, so that's an advantage. The federal government, in discussions with us, doesn't seem interested in investing in that plant or in those processes to use that plant in a meaningful way. And I don't think the states, in Arizona in particular, are really interested in doing a lot of the funding that would be necessary to move that plant. So there's lots of challenges with that Yuma plant. And one of the challenges we have in many of the areas within Arizona to do brackish groundwater desalinization is the folks in the areas where that groundwater exists are concerned about that groundwater being treated and potentially moved away from their area of origin. So we need to, in any project we might contemplate, look at area of origin impacts on the local areas where that groundwater exists.
Is the brackish water that's underground in Arizona currently being used for other purposes?
In some cases, it is. Some of it is still of good enough quality that it could be used and is used, like in the West Valley, in some cases for irrigation. In some cases, it's blended for other purposes. But in terms of drinking water, it certainly needs treatment to be able to be used for drinking water purposes.
Best case scenario, how much of a dent do you think that a plant like the one you're talking about with Mexico along the Sea of Cortez could put in Arizona's water shortage problems?
It is helpful in solving the problem because there's no kind of low-hanging fruit or one solution to those issues. Many different things are going to have to be cobbled together. So if you could do, for example, 50,000 acre feet that could come into central Arizona, that's a substantial volume of water, right? So it would be one piece of various activities that would have to occur.
Is 50,000 acre feet a reasonable projection, do you think?
I think that is something that we could achieve, and maybe even twice that.
Tom Bouchonsky is director of the Arizona Department of Water Resources.
A number of colleges and universities are moving beyond one of the most basic elements they've used to determine whether a student has what it takes to be accepted for enrollment. Basic scores on the SAT are no longer being taken at face value in quite the same way. As part of an environmental context dashboard, there's a so-called adversity score or adversity index that may provide context for a student's SAT score. So how is that going to affect applicants and overall enrollment? Eric Hoover of the Chronicle of Higher Education has done extensive reporting on the topic and is with me. Eric, how relevant does the SAT continue to be?
Still very relevant for applicants who are hoping to get admission at one of the most selective colleges or universities in the country. More and more colleges are no longer requiring the ACT or SAT, but as you go on up the ladder of selectivity and prestige, nearly all of those institutions still require students to take one or both of those tests.
All right, now the adversity index, where does that come into play and how would you define it?
The adversity index is designed to give colleges a better sense of where students are coming from. And I mean that literally as well as figuratively. So the adversity index, as it's called, is really just giving admissions offices a tool, kind of shorthand tool for gauging various metrics of disadvantage or hardship that a given student has come from. This is looking at their background. The number isn't really attached to that student himself or herself, if you will, but it's meant to give admissions offices who are overwhelmed with applications and ever more pressed for time a quick gauge of education level, the opportunities that a student has at his or her high school.
So a quick gauge, is it meant to be a fairer gauge potentially?
I think it goes to this point, Steve, and that is the most selective institutions are concerned about not just what an applicant has achieved, they're also trying to better understand the context for those achievements. So you and I might have both taken five advanced placement courses in our junior year of high school. But at your high school, there were only five offered. And at mine, there were 18 offered. Does that mean that one of us is better than the other? No, not necessarily. But having that contextual background, a little bit better understanding of the yardstick that might make sense to measure one applicant's success might not be the best yardstick to use when looking at another applicant based on the varying levels of advantage that we know so many students bring to the table.
Eric, to some extent, I mean, I definitely see that point, but I'm also struck by the fact that with universities being bombarded by applications and trying to figure it out, it almost feels like once we get into really learning more about a student's background or, as you mentioned, some of the advantages or disadvantages a student may have had at a particular school, it almost feels like that is potentially too much information for the university, even if it's more valid information. Does that in and of itself create any complications?
It's a good question. I do think the C word in this case, the context, really is something that admissions offices are trying to get a better handle on, a fuller picture of an applicant. We know that the most selective institutions practice something called holistic admissions review. And so not just these numbers and letters attached to our names, our grades, and our test scores, but more about the applicants themselves. So yes, it does bring another level of complexity and another layer of detail to look at. But I don't think most admissions folks would say it's TMI, too much information. Most colleges that are using this tool to gauge diversity so far would say, sure, it's a little more detail, it's a little more information, but that's a good thing that helps them do their jobs and make decisions and not a bad thing.
So how much do colleges and universities need this going forward, because we're just seeing changes in higher education, whether it's more diversity, whether it's fewer people going the traditional route or choosing their own path? Is this something that, however it works out initially, makes sense, that there needs to be sort of an innovative look at this and not just rely on ACT, SAT?
Yeah, I think nuance is something that admissions folks in the time frame that they have, which is a very limited window of time, nuance is something that admissions offices generally want to embrace. And so I think the schools that are using this so far, the colleges that are using this, feel like it adds a helpful dash of nuance. So far, admissions folks that are using this feel like it's really just a tool used on the margins to make some fine distinctions among handfuls of applicants. This is not taking over the core work of college admissions. But to your point, it does give you a better picture of that immense diversity, not only among students coming in, but also it's a reminder that we have so many different types of institutions.
When it comes to this kind of change, this specific change, how impactful a point in time do you think this is? Is this going to be seen as potentially kind of a blip, or does this indicate more of the direction we're going to see from higher education?
I would say probably more of a blip, again, because this new tool is really just building upon something that many highly selective colleges already do, which is to dig down into census level data, neighborhood level data, and try to figure out, okay, where does a student fit in? How do we think about their achievements in a more nuanced way? But all the forces that work against the consideration of nuance and often diversity, they're not going away just because there's a new tool. The battle for prestige, the sincere wish by many folks who lead colleges and universities to move up in the rankings, to game the system in many cases, I just don't see those forces ebbing anytime soon. Even among the most elite institutions who seem to have everything going for them, there's this constant jockeying for position. So I think the real question is, which institutions embrace diversity more broadly and finance that commitment in a meaningful way, and which do not?
Eric Hoover is a reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.